Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the subscribe, submit, and support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 76, Margaret Sanger, New York City Sites, Day 1, Part 3. Tuesday, October 18th, 2016, continued. I continue north to the Roosevelt Hotel at Madison Avenue and East 45th Street. Margaret Sanger attended the Conference on Contraceptive Research and Clinical Practice that met here on December 29th and 30th in 1936. She delivered a welcoming speech on the 29th and spoke on a panel the next day, which discussed technical and medical birth control issues. While the New York Times reported optimistically on the effectiveness of birth control methods available at the time, and Sanger spoke proudly of the 56,000 women who have voluntarily appealed to us for help, she and many of the other attendees knew that the lack of access to and effectiveness of birth control remained big problems. It was still fairly expensive. Anti-obscenity laws were barriers to access and information in those pre-Griswold years, and too many of the methods were only moderately effective, since they were not always easy to use correctly, especially in, well, you know, the heat of the moment. But despite these problems, Sanger had reasons to be optimistic. The birth control movement had seen some successes in the 20 years since the raid of her first clinic in 1916. One of the most important was the recent decision in United States versus One Package of Japanese Pessaries, what a name, in which the United States Court of Appeals upheld the decision of a lower court from earlier that year regarding a shipment of birth control devices that U.S. Customs had confiscated under the Comstock laws, which prohibited sending so-called obscene items through the mail. Sanger had ordered a case of unusually shaped diaphragms from Japan and requested that U.S. Customs forward them to her friend and colleague Dr. Hannah Stone. The circumstances of this shipment, between two physicians and across state lines, was arranged by Sanger and her lawyer Morris Ernst to create a test case to try and defeat the old Comstock laws. As they hoped, the courts decided that obscenity laws, which had been broadly applied to prevent dissemination of information about contraception and the distribution of contraceptive devices themselves, could not be applied to the legitimate practice of medicine. But the birth control movement had a long way to go. It would take three more decades before the Supreme Court weighed in on the issue of birth control, specifically. Speaking of Roosevelt, for whom this hotel was named, and I assume, based on the sculpture of him prominently displayed in an upper lobby, Theodore Roosevelt, was very much opposed to birth control. He feared that the very people who should be having the most children, the most talented, intelligent, and well-educated, the healthiest and the wealthiest, were the very ones who were having fewer than ever. He believed the falling birth rate could lead to what he called race suicide, and opposed any and all methods that would facilitate this trend. Though Sanger and Roosevelt both believed in eugenics principles, their conclusions were very different when it came to population issues and the right to reproductive self-determination. I explore the differences in their views which led to their different conclusions in an earlier essay I wrote as part of this series, Why hate Margaret Sanger? Burp. Why so much hatred for Margaret Sanger? Sanger publicly and vigorously opposed Roosevelt's public positions on birth control and the population question. In Sanger's article, Birth Control, Margaret Sanger's Reply to Theodore Roosevelt, published in the Metropolitan Magazine in December of 1917, she described why she believed his views were short-sighted and ill-informed. I zigzag northeast to the Barclay Hotel at 111 East 48th Street, between Park and Lexington Avenues. According to Robin Pokorsky of the Margaret Sanger Papers Project, quote, Sanger stayed at the Barclay Hotel in April and May 1938, and again in January 1939. I tracked down a listing in the Margaret Sanger Papers Microfilm Edition, Smith College Collection Series Catalog, for a microfilm of a letter Sanger received from the Barclay Hotel, but I don't have access to it at the moment. It's not available online, and I've not yet had a chance to visit the library at the University of California at Berkeley, which has a copy. I'll update this account if I find anything interesting in the letter when I do get over there, and if I come across any other interesting details relating to her stay here in my continued research. In the meantime, I'll continue with my story so I can publish it in good time. I continue on a few blocks away, heading east, to 242 East 49th Street, between 3rd and 2nd Avenues, to a brownstone at Turtle Bay Gardens. Sanger founded the American Birth Control League here at her friend Juliet Barrett Rubley's home in 1921. Rubley, the wealthy wife of an influential lawyer, enthusiastically devoted her time and money to supporting feminist, humanitarian, and artistic causes. She's a fascinating character, an activist, a nurse, a filmmaker, and an adventurer, whose exciting lifestyle was very well funded by her enormous fortune, leaving plenty of money to lavish on such projects as Sanger's pamphlet, Family Limitation, and magazine, The Birth Control Review, first published in February of 1917. Rubley took an active interest in Sanger's work since Sanger was arrested for opening her birth control clinic in 1916, and they remained the closest of friends for the rest of their lives, dying only a few months apart. They wrote to each other often in intimate and detailed letters, many of which each kept, though they had marked them, destroy upon reading. The Margaret Sanger Papers Project describes their correspondence as among the resources that reveal most about Sanger's inner life. As with any public figure, especially one as controversial and embattled as Sanger, it can be difficult to get past a persona, the defensive walls they feel the need to construct. Turtle Bay Gardens Historic District stands on what was once a bay of the East River, where ships harbored, country farmhouses stood, and Edgar Allan Poe used to go diving off the rocks. The bay was gradually filled in, and the once thriving and handsome industrial district, with its breweries, mills, and carpentry shops, turned into a squalid, overcrowded district packed with cheap tenements, slaughterhouses, and rundown warehouses. One part of this neighborhood was destroyed in the riots that followed the establishment of a Civil War draft conscription office here in 1863. When Sanger established the American Birth Control League at Rubley's Turtle Bay home in 1921, it would have very recently been renovated and turned into a place of beauty and luxury. Another wealthy heiress, Charlotte Martin, bought this and an adjoining row of rundown brownstones in 1919 and thoroughly remodeled them, with a lush garden, complete with a copy of a fountain from Rome's Villa Medici in the center, inspired by the European gardens she had fallen in love with during her travels, to create a haven of elegance and refuge in this what was then out-of-the-way, unfashionably too far east neighborhood of Manhattan. And, by the way, as I just discovered, one of my favorite musical artists, Bob Dylan, used to live here at number 242 as well. I backtrack on 49th and turn right to 301 Park Avenue, to the Waldorf Astoria between 49th and 50th Streets. There are three occasions in the life of Sanger which bring me here. On January 5th, 1917, Sanger participated in one of the many debates on birth control she would take part in over the years. I'll soon visit another site where she participated in a well-publicized debate 4 years later. I've found the text of it published online where I can share it with you, so I'll wait to discuss her debate topics and style then. Over 14 years later, on October 23rd, 1931, Sanger addressed the attendees of a dinner honoring H.G. Wells, an important influence, longtime friend, and occasional lover. Wells shared many of her views on economics and eugenics, as well as her abiding concern that too many children were born into families and communities that didn't have the capabilities to feed and care for them properly, leading to needless suffering and death. Wells's article, The Needless Waste of Human Lives, was published in the first edition of Sanger's Birth Control Review, which described the plight of children born into poverty and privation only to be soon forced into labor in the most heart-wrenching terms this literary star could summon. Wells supported Sanger's work in many other ways, both personal and public, some of which she described and thanked him for in her address that night. One of the ways Wells supported Sanger was by adding his influential name to an appeal to President Woodrow Wilson to get the many indictments which had piled up against her dropped. Most importantly, however, it was the enduring friendship with this famed man of like mind which propped up her confidence and spirits throughout the years until his death in 1946. On May 11, 1961, the Waldorf Astoria also hosted a World Tribute Dinner for Margaret Sanger, organized as a fundraiser by the World Population Emergency Campaign and chaired by the renowned evolutionary biologist Julian Huxley. It was Sanger's last public appearance, since by that time she had developed heart disease, and while the alcohol and Demerol she treated her pain with may have helped in that regard, she was often tired, confused, and emotionally volatile. The senility which would incapacitate her within a few short years may have been starting to set in as well. But she was delighted at the invitation, and she rallied what strength she could to get to New York, assisted by her younger son Stuart, and briefly deliver her thanks. Even this was too much, and she nodded off in her chair shortly afterward. Sanger would live 5.5 more years, 4 of these in a nursing home, dying just before her 88th birthday. She enjoyed intermittent bouts of lucidity until her last year of life, and appeared to understand the significance of the Supreme Court decision in Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965 when she was given the news. "It's about time," she said. It seemed as obvious to her, as it does most of us today, that people had a right to privacy in their sexual relationships, yet the Comstockism she had fought for so long proved tenacious in American law and culture. My next stop is the northwest corner of 51st Street and Park Avenue. According to Plate 78 of G.W. Bromley's 1921-1923 Atlas of the City of New York, the Ambassador Hotel used to stand at Park Avenue and across 51st Street from St. Bart's, as the beautiful 1835 St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church is commonly known. There's a nondescript office high-rise building here now. The Ambassador Hotel is linked to Sanger in two ways. One, she stayed here on several occasions in late 1936 after she returned from a trip to India. While there, she toured the country and discussed and debated population and poverty issues, law, women's rights, and birth control with Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi opposed artificial means of birth control. He shared the Catholic Church's position that sex without the possibility of procreation is a form of animal lust unworthy of a spiritual being. He believed that human respect, understanding, and true spiritual connection were incompatible with carnal desire. However, he did believe in the right of women to control their own bodies insofar as they should never be coerced into having sex, and that they had full rights of refusal for any reason, within marriage as well as without. Singer strongly disagreed with his views. She believed that sexual union could be as spiritually transcendent as it was pleasurable, one of the most beautiful, intimate, and powerful ways in which human beings connect with one another. And she believed that when partners were forced to refuse sex to one another for fear of having children, it undermined the harmony and romance between couples, thereby breaking up marriages and destroying families. I recommend reading her debate with Gandhi, published in Asia magazine, which was not held in public but fortunately preserved because her secretary, Florence Rose, had the presence of mind to record it in shorthand. I'll further explore Sanger's ideas about sex, love, and interpersonal spirituality in an essay I plan to publish before long. Secondly, the Ambassador Hotel was also the site of a special joint meeting of the American Birth Control League and the National Committee on Federal Legislation for Birth Control following the December 7, 1936, United States Court of Appeals ruling in the one package case I discuss at the beginning of this piece. In this decision, Appellate Judge Augustus Noblehand, again, what a name, upheld Judge Grover M. Mockovitz's decision from earlier that year, which prohibited the government from interfering with mail from doctors sending medical devices and information. This case seriously undermined the Comstock laws and was an important moment in extracting, isolating, and describing the right to privacy, implied but never specified in the Constitution, in American jurisprudence. I head next to 485 Madison Avenue, between 52nd and 51st Streets, to the former Columbia Broadcasting System offices where WABC radio broadcasts were recorded. The founder of CBS, William S. Paley, had taken over as president of the tiny radio network United Independent Broadcasters, founded in Chicago in early 1927. The savvy Paley quickly put the newly expanded media operation, which he bought the majority share of and renamed CBS, on firm financial footing, good enough to move to new, sleek 485 Madison Avenue in New York City in 1929. He wanted his new company to be where the action was, well situated for success. CBS stayed here until it moved into its own specially designed building in 1965. Margaret Sanger recorded a radio broadcast here on birth control on April 11, 1935, which was distributed to many radio stations throughout the country. In it, she outlined her basic arguments in favor of birth control, which we've already considered: the benefits to women's and children's health, the right to reproductive self-determination, and so on, as well as her incredulity that the United States was now the only advanced country to legally prohibit birth control on obscenity grounds, in defiance of what she had perceived as a preponderance of medical opinion in its favor. In reality, the science of reproduction was still at a very early stage, and there was far less of a medical consensus that birth control is safe, effective, and on the whole, medically beneficial for women as there is today. She also announced plans for a petition directly to the second President Roosevelt, who she hoped would be much more progressive in this matter than the first one was. Sanger had a good reason for these hopes. Eleanor Roosevelt was also a longtime supporter of the right to free access to medically approved forms of birth control. However, once Roosevelt's husband Franklin became president, she felt she could no longer publicly state her views on this issue. When asked, Roosevelt would neither oppose nor support the issue, stating simply that she refused to discuss it. Singer understood and didn't much blame the First Lady for making that choice. Like Singer, Roosevelt was a strong woman who spent her days working hard on behalf of progressive causes. And like Singer, she was willing to compromise and choose her battles when she felt it was necessary. The last site I visit for the day is the Rockefeller Center at 5th Avenue and 50th Street, another of New York City's grand edifices I've been wanting to see. According to Pokorsky, Singer met with John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s aide Arthur Packard at Rockefeller Center in October of 1936. The Rockefeller Center is handsome outside, breathtaking inside. It glows even brighter, more golden and coppery and gem-like than the inside of the Chrysler Building. My camera doesn't do justice to what I'm seeing since it has such difficulties in low light, but it does capture its amber-like quality. I tracked down a memorandum of a conversation between Singer and Packard dated October 9, 1936, so I assume this memorandum discusses that meeting. One of Packard's primary duties was to help select projects that the wealthy philanthropist Rockefeller might wish to fund. A humanitarian and progressive, Rockefeller was interested in Singer's work and helped fund many of her projects over the years. In this case, Singer and Packard were discussing a new form of sponge and spermicidal foam birth control that Singer had become aware of through Dr. Lydia DeVilbiss, which Packard amusingly misspells as Devilbus, of Florida, who had been prescribing it to her patients. In addition to the further research on this method Singer wanted to help fund, they discussed the one package case and Singer's increasing doubts about some of the long-term ramifications of the case as it was being argued. As you may recall, Singer, Ernst, and Dr. Stone had arranged the circumstances that led to this test case purposefully so that it would be argued largely as a case about the right to practice medicine, since it involved devices shipped from doctor to doctor. However, Singer was growing more concerned that this would focus too much on the rights of medical practitioners to make decisions in these matters and not enough on the rights of the women themselves. Perhaps the fact that it took another 30 years for the Supreme Court to base their decision in a major birth control case on the right to privacy, and hence to self-determination, is enough to demonstrate that Singer's fears were well-founded. It's dark now, a beautiful balmy night, so I end my day's Singer explorations and just wander freely a bit before I head back for dinner. I still have 3 more days to go, so stay tuned. As always, thank you for listening.